From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Our news is full of statistics, but how much can we trust them? In our first half hour today, Dubuque author Ed Zicaro will tell us how we can be scammed by statistics. That's the title of his new book. Then in our second half hour, we'll talk about network neutrality, a guiding principle that preserves free and open internet access. We'll discuss how net neutrality may be affected by an upcoming FCC vote. We'll talk with Iowa State University journalism professor Jeff Blevins. Also, Tony Townsend, professor of management information systems at Iowa State University's College of Business. That's all coming up. First, this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We are continually bombarded by charts, graphs, numbers from various studies, all with the goal of influencing our opinions. Anything from what toothpaste to buy, what candidate to vote for, what actions will help our personal health, or the health of our sick economy. My first guest wants us to know when the statistics are not all they're cracked up to be. My guest in this first half hour, Dubuque-based author and math educator Edward Zicaro. He joins us to talk about his new book, Scammed by Statistics, How We Are Lied to, Cheated, and Manipulated by Statistics, and Why You Should Care. Ed Zicaro joins us in the studios of Iowa Public Radio this afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you for driving to Iowa City from Dubuque through the snow. Yeah. Glad to see you here in good shape.
Thank you for having me. It was a harrowing drive, but it was okay.
As you point out in your book, we like to think that the beauty of statistics is that they give us an objective look at a situation, like referees or umpires, that they will tell the true picture. You're saying this is not always the case.
Well, the problem isn't with the statistics. They do tell the true picture. It's when people start manipulating them to because they don't like what they tell them. So, for example, if an oat company wants to push that oats lowers cholesterol, the statistic says that oats do lower cholesterol a little bit, about 4%. So the graph they show the public in their ads, the bar graphs make it appear like oats will drop cholesterol by 75%. So the visual is the manipulation in that case.
Mm-hmm. So they've just sort of cropped the graph to show only that 4% and exaggerate how big that looks.
Yes. They play with the y-axis. So I always tell people, make sure you look at the scale on graphs, especially bar graphs.
Mm-hmm. We want to reach out to our listeners for this half hour. Perhaps you've run across a statistic that you thought was questionable, was a scam. You'd like to share it with us this half hour, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. 1-866-780-9100 for a statistic that sticks in your mind. And you said that is just being misused. We can check it out here in this half hour. You point to the tobacco industry as true masters of statistical manipulation. Give us an egregious example that you'd like to illustrate with.
I put the tobacco company in the their technique they use is purposely fogging clarity. Tobacco became very, very clear at 50, 60, 70 years ago that tobacco was dangerous. And there was study after study showed that it was dangerous. And what they ended up doing, even after the definitive study was 1954, they had to stop early because people were dying at a high rate who were smoking. And they had to stop the study and announce there's a real problem with tobacco. The tobacco company then and there should have said, maybe there's a problem with the research, but we have to assume it does kill people. But they didn't. They hired people to do all kinds of other studies that just sort of fog the truth.
So to go into that, I don't understand. How do you fog the truth when you say statistics themselves do not lie?
Well, they'll hire people to do a study of, for example, the scientists came out and said nicotine is like exercise, some scientists they had hired. And they also had a thing, maybe it's genetics that causes this. Maybe people are more prone to lung cancer, want to smoke. And so they throw out all kinds of alternative explanations.
And in question form.
Yes, they didn't say tobacco is definitely safe. They said, we think it is safe. And they did full page ads in newspapers saying, we're very concerned with the health of our smokers. We will start a research group. Now, when you pay a research group with tobacco money, you have to question what comes out of it. And what came out of it was nonsense. Mm-hmm. But it was meant to just confuse people. Their technique was, let's just throw a bunch of stuff everywhere. Hopefully a little bit will stick and people won't stop smoking.
Right. And unfortunately, that for many decades, that type of work was effective.
Oh, very. Up to very recently when they said with a straight face in front of Congress, nicotine is not addictive. That's the same as saying the sun doesn't come up. I mean, it was just clear nicotine is addictive. So that shows you how far they'll go.
You talk about this technique of fogging technique, and you also point to a case that we have in our memory here of the O.J. Simpson case as a use of this technique. Explain how that was used in the O.J. Simpson trial.
That was just a classic case of purposely fogging clarity. The prosecution put on for a long time, they presented their case that O.J. was a wife abuser, which was pretty clear from photos of his wife, police reports. It was pretty clear he's a wife abuser. So the defense had a problem with how to respond to that. So what they did, they told the jury a true statistic that only 1 in 2,500 abusers end up killing their partner. Mm-hmm. And that's a true statistic. But on the face of it, it looks powerful that there's a slim chance that even though he abused her, he killed her. But that isn't relevant. The relevant question and the relevant statistic was, if an abused woman ends up dead, how often is the abuser the murderer? And in that case, it's over 90%. So the jury was presented with 1 in 2,500.
And that was just the wrong statistic to bring up. Totally irrelevant.
It's totally irrelevant, but it sounds relevant. That's the diabolical beauty of it. And the prosecution did not respond with the correct statistic either. Mm-hmm. So one of the things people have to do is know how to spot manipulate statistics and respond quickly.
Okay, so that's one of the questions you should ask yourself whenever you hear a statistic, perhaps from that O.J. Simpson case as a lesson to say, but is this statistic relevant?
Absolutely.
The relevancy of the statistic brought to the fore.
Is it relevant? And always, always when you hear a statistic, see who's giving it to you. Is there money involved? Is there something to be gained from that statistic?
Okay, let's go to our first caller, 1-866-780-9100. We're looking for your questions about statistical scams. We're talking about this with Ed Zaccaro, his new book, Scammed by Statistics. Perhaps you have one in mind. Des Moines is on the line. Tim is in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Tim.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to bring up to Ed something that you often see in statistics, particularly reported to the public, is, let's take an example. Maybe they'll say that an energy drink improves your performance while exercising by 20%. Well, that's an absolute statistic. Now, drinking water while exercising will improve your performance by 15%. So essentially, relative to water, it's really only improving by 5%. So oftentimes, they'll report on the absolute rather than the relative statistic. So that's just something I was wondering if you could maybe expound upon, Ed.
Tim, thank you for that comment from Des Moines. Ed Zaccaro.
Yeah, I call that selective use of statistics, where you point out something that sounds good, but you don't give the whole picture. And that's a great example of it.
Brian writes us an email. He says, I once got a fortune cookie that said 76% of all statistics are made up on the spot, including this one. Actually, it is a point that you make in your book. If you don't have the statistics to back up your case, what do you do, Ed? You
just make some up.
And that's done how frequently?
Well, very, very frequently. The more clever way to do it is to manipulate them. But sometimes people don't want to go to that trouble, so they just make them up. The classic case is people today still think that subliminal messages in movies can impact your buying habits because of a famous experiment by James Vickery in 1954. He put buy popcorn flashed very quickly at movie screens, and that's in textbooks now that will influence your buying habits. But the truth of the matter is, James Vickery, he didn't even do the experiment. He just totally made up the experiment and the statistics. But it's still in college textbooks today, more than 50 years later.
So the question would then naturally be, how do poor statistics or completely made-up statistics get perpetuated? I have a feeling that perhaps, textbook makers, the news media, can be lazy at times, simply pass on things, as can prosecutors in the O.J. Simpson case, simply be lazy and not really scratch ahead and say, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Well, the problem with it is so difficult to stop a made-up statistic. If somebody quotes it, then five other people quote the people who quoted it, and it just grows and grows and grows, and no one knew where it came from. Another example of it, in 1980s, the biggest advocate for the homeless was a man named Schneider, and he said on the news over and over again, there are 3 million homeless. No one questioned him. It was quoted all over the country, 3 million homeless, until Ted Koppel asked him about it. And he eventually, with some pressure from Ted Koppel, admitted he just made the whole thing up. That there really, it ended up there were about 300,000 homeless. But somebody asked him for a number. He came up with 3 million, and it just spread and spread.
Armando is with us, joining us from Galena, Illinois. I imagine, Armando, up in Galena, you have a good deal of snow. That's not just a statistical.
Well, I would say about 12%.
Armando, what's your question for Ed Zaccaro?
I'll tell you 12% about what. Well, my question is that, about the problem with global warming, and then there is a lot of people out there, particularly on the right, that say that it's totally non-existent, and they show some statistics. And it's like what you guys were talking about before about the OJ trial. Which ones are the right statistics? The ones that says that global warming exists, or the one that says, "Oh no, we can keep using all these pollutants forever." So it's like, who is really telling the truth?
Now, global warming is a great example because you brought up a good point. Both sides will say statistics, and people in the middle who aren't scientists don't know who to believe. And one of the problems is, to me, and I'm not an expert in this by any means, but the statistics for global warming are overwhelming in favor of that there is climate change. But on the side, the people who are proponents of that there is global warming made a couple small manipulations. Al Gore in his movie, which was a very good movie. Al Gore has lots of good points on global warming, but he said that hurricanes are increasing intensity, and he showed the increasing amount of damage through the years, which wasn't a good statistic because he didn't adjust for inflation, population growth on the coast. And so people will point to that as it's all nonsense because a couple people manipulate statistics. So the point is, if you find a mistake on the other side, it doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that statistic that they used is incorrect. And people are dismissing global warming because of a small manipulation.
Armando, thank you very much. Calling from Galena, Illinois. Thank you for your call, Armando. 1-866-780-9100. An email from Rick is interesting because it gets at something you point out in your book. Rick writes to us, there is an intentional misuse of statistics. But there is also the incompetent use of statistics. I have long fretted about NPR's inability to grasp basic statistical concepts, such as the difference between correlation and causation, or the use of small sample sizes. So comment on that. You talk about this cause and correlation confusion in your book, Ed.
Cause-correlation confusion is a big problem when you're interpreting statistics and whether something's true or not. NPR had a great example of where they sort of missed the boat on it. And that was there was a show in the fall about Canada stopped giving vaccines flu vaccines because they found a what they thought was a lot more people were getting swine flu who were vaccinated, and they thought the flu vaccine was causing swine flu. Mm-hmm. And in reality, they should have looked at cause correlation issues with it, because people who get flu vaccines are more susceptible to any flu, and of course they're going to get the swine flu a lot more. Mm-hmm. So but it went on for a few months, and Canada stopped vaccinating people for the flu for a while, except for those over 65, until it dawned on somebody this was a cause correlation issue.
You're not saying here in this book that it's necessarily easy to spot problems in statistics and using them to back cases, are you? Because in some cases, you say it is extremely difficult, and even experts can be fooled or not notice what's going on.
Yeah, the whole medical establishment in Canada was fooled by this simple cause correlation issue, what hope do the public have to try to look through this? There's a lot of that was just a mistake. It wasn't manipulated. It was just they made a mistake. So there's not only mistakes, there's manipulation. So the public has to be on their toes.
Okay, let's go to Sally in Marshalltown. Hi, Sally. Welcome to our program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, go ahead. We've got a couple minutes left.
I had a couple of things. One, in response to the comment about the statistics about hurricanes and the Al Gore Inconvenient Truth climate project, I was one of the people trained to do those presentations. And when we were trained to do that, the statistics basically were saying that, and they were based on data out of MIT, that hurricanes are increasing in intensity. There weren't any specific statistics that directly correlated that to damage. It was more of an inference, because it is true that the statistics on insurance indicated that insurance companies are paying out more and more amounts because of more and more disasters, et cetera. But it was never taught or explained in that way that it was a direct correlation. It was just to show that, you know, they are increasing in intensity, and these are the kinds of things that happen. The other thing I just wanted to mention was I have a great quote. It's an anonymous quote. I learned it years ago, and I've used it over and over again in my teaching. And it goes, statistics is like a bikini. What it reveals is provocative, but what it conceals is vital. And it's just kind of fun to get people thinking a little bit about how they use their statistics.
Sally in Marshalltown, thank you so much for that. And you, Ed Zaccaro has a number of quotes in the book. Do you have a favorite statistic quote?
Yeah, my favorite is some people use statistics like a drunk uses a lamppost for support rather than illumination.
John is with us from Des Moines. Thank you for calling 1-866-780-9100. John, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A great topic, and I'm actually in the pharmaceutical industry. And I'd like to get your guest comments on the statistics. And I've seen a lot of the clinical studies on medicines, whether it's adverse effects or its ability to help people, get pretty marketed in the pieces that go out to physicians, quite a elaboration or extension of the statistic. And also whether it's relative risk reductions or absolute risk reductions for a patient population, meaning most people just want to know how many people do you need to treat with this expensive medicine, right, to help alleviate disease. So,
John, in your work in the pharmaceutical industry, do you shop around statistics that you know are fudging it a bit?
No. Actually, the industry and has come under great scrutiny because of the topic is so critical, right, to be revealing information from a study. You want to be exactly accurate of the information you're relaying. So I do know that practices have waned in that area, like you say, but we're in charge of giving the exact information as it is in the label and within studies. So I guess what I'm saying is, there's no shopping around. You can get in big trouble and all kinds of things like that. So, but I have seen marketing use graphs extrapolating a 0.1 to a 0.2% increase, a 50% increase in a big number, if you know what I mean.
Okay, John, let's get a comment from Ed Zaccaro as our time dwindles here.
Yeah, I wish I had time. The drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies, there's hours to spend on that. They pay doctors, they design studies, they write the articles, they analyze the research, they decide what the public sees. It's just ripe for problems. One example of poor statistical interpretation killed 40,000 people, and that was Vioxx. The FDA said Vioxx caused over 100,000 heart attacks, and probably approximately 40,000 people died just from Vioxx. And that is just one example. The pharmaceutical company, they are improving because of new laws. New York took them on a few years back. Elliot Spitzer, for all his problems, he did some good in that area.
Now you point out also in your book, of course, in the I think majority of cases, of course, statistics are used for good, for saving lives.
Correct. There was a study. A doctor saw what was killing people in hospitals, and he developed a statistical model to try to prevent those deaths in hospitals, got 75% of the hospitals to sign up. And by just using statistics, he saved 120,000 lives in 18 months just by the use of statistics.
Here's something in your book that can ring true for so many people as they're gathered around. We're gathered around the Thanksgiving table with extended family and will be over the holidays, that people tend to believe what they want to. They tend to believe, you say in your book, the statistics they want to. It's called a confirmation bias.
Correct. That's one of the problems. Our brains were built to look for patterns. Otherwise, we would have died out years ago. Natural selection favored those who saw patterns. And we tend to find patterns when they're not there. It's just the structure of our brain. And when we want to believe something, we believe it.
So when we're locked into a pattern and we're perhaps having a heated argument with a relative at that holiday dinner table, it's not a surprise when you bring up a statistic that seems to refute what the person across from you is saying. And they say, well, I just don't believe that.
Oh, yeah. I've been around long enough. I don't try to change people's minds. I've learned after hundreds of arguments over the years that people believe what they want to believe, especially true believers, that they just want to argue. So I don't try to change people's minds.
Ed Zaccaro, we have about a minute left. So what words of advice can you give us for consuming statistics more sensibly so we don't get scammed?
Always look at who's giving you the statistic, what they have to gain. If the CDC, Center for Disease Control, is giving you a statistic, I would trust that for the most part. If a pharmaceutical company gives you a statistic, I'm not to say don't trust it, but be a little wary of it. Always look on graphs at the y-axis, the scale, because advertisers know Americans in general don't look at the scale, and they can do some really, really dire manipulations, knowing people will just look at the visuals and not the scale.
And very quickly before we go, have statistics become more dangerous? The people wielding them become better at it?
Oh, they absolutely. They're becoming much more sophisticated how they manipulate the data, much more. And we need to teach this more in high school and college, how to look at data. And we're not doing a good job on that.
Ed Zaccaro, thank you for joining us. Scammed by Statistics, Ed Zaccaro's latest book. He's a Dubuque-based author and math educator. How we are lied to, cheated, and manipulated by statistics, and why we should care. Ed Zaccaro, thank you for coming into our studio today.
Thank you.
When we come back here on The Exchange, we'll talk about network neutrality. What is it? And how could proposed changes by the FCC next week, there's a vote coming, affect your internet access? We'll discuss that with professors from Iowa State University. When we return, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on The Exchange over the noon hour on this snowy December day. I'm Ben Kiefer, your host. When we log on to the internet, we take lots of things for granted. We assume that we'll be able to access whatever website we want whenever we want to go there. We also assume that we can use any feature we like watching online videos, listening to Iowa Public Radio podcasts, searching, emailing, instant messaging, anytime we use we choose these features and many others. But what makes all these assumptions possible is something called network neutrality. It's been a guiding principle that preserves free and open internet access, but that may change under a new draft proposal on net neutrality regulations set for the Federal Communications Commission in a vote next week. Joining us now to discuss net neutrality and possible changes from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames, Jeff Blevins, Associate Professor at Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. Welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. Also joining Jeff and I, Tony Townsend, Associate Professor of Management Information Systems in Iowa State's College of Business. Tony, welcome.
Thanks.
Jeff, if I can throw this out to you first of all, tell us, what is network neutrality? How should we think of that to grasp it easily?
Well, in short, network neutrality is the idea that internet service providers should afford equal interconnection among content providers and users of the network, so that those who control access to the network, that is the internet service providers, they do not censor lawful content or enact discriminatory routing of content, so that as you, the user, pay for access to the internet, you should be able to visit any site that is lawful online or use any service that is lawful online.
Mm-hmm. So often we have this metaphor, this analogy of plumbing, of pipes coming into our houses, into our businesses. So, and that fits with it in the sense that the companies who allow that to come into our houses, what don't mess with the content. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Okay. What changes then are being proposed? This is the FCC chairman, right?
Yes. This is Chairman Julius Genachowski's proposal. And it's interesting. Currently, we really don't have any network neutrality policy other than an agreement that was made to by AT&T and Bell South when they merged to abide by a certain set of principles. And what Chairman Genachowski is proposing is that these principles become law.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how would that change what we have now?
How would it change what we have now is interesting question. You would think that the proponents of network neutrality would be pleased with this proposal, but they are not, primarily because it would not apply to wireless internet providers. So that is your mobile networks. While it would, formalize that, we do have neutrality over wired broadband, it would not be the case over wireless networks, which have grown immensely in popularity.
Okay. Who or what is driving the proposed changes?
It's interesting. There has been a real coalition of proponents for network neutrality, and it's an eclectic group. Gun Owners of America, Consumers Union, American Library Association, Common Cause, Christian Coalition, ACLU, Feminist Majority.
All in bed together on this one.
And strange bedfellows. And anytime you get that eclectic group together, something extraordinary is happening.
Hmm. Okay. So I've read that the opponents of net neutrality characterize its regulations as a solution in search of a problem, arguing that broadband service providers have no plans to block content or degrade network performance. People are afraid that this change will do, in fact, that. And what do you think of that?
Well, yeah, some critics of the proposal say that it doesn't have enough teeth, that it would be guidelines, and primarily that it just asks for transparency. In other words, it asked internet service providers to make plain, what sites they discriminate against, if you will. So really, we should think of transparency as fine print. This means that somewhere in the terms of service for your internet service provider, they'll tell you what sites they are blocking.
Mm. So we want to get our listeners in on this conversation, talk more about how this affects the us consumers, also businesses. Tony Townsend will be in on that. But I want to throw out our email and our telephone, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions about net neutrality and this vote coming up. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. So before we go to Tony with the business side of this FCC vote, what could this mean for everyday consumers?
Well, particularly for wireless consumers, it means that you could pay more. You pay for to have internet service on your mobile phone. Well, now if you want to use Facebook, that's going to be an additional charge. If you want to access YouTube, well, does your carrier allow that? And if they do, is there an extra charge?
Okay, so what I'm getting here is you're describing something akin to our cable TV, where I buy a package of channels or I pay a premium for certain channels.
Absolutely. I think cable television is an excellent analogy. Even if you're willing or able to pay extra, it might depend on whether or not your provider has a relationship with the content or the services that you want online. And if they don't, well, then they have an economic incentive not to allow you access to those services or that content.
Tony Townsend, you are an associate professor of management information systems at Iowa State's College of Business. You study information technology, organizational effectiveness. So what is the business angle on this vote and this possible change that you can tell us about?
Well, it's kind of multifaceted. I mean, I would probably offer an alternative to what Jeff was talking about with regard to how the thing's going to work out with regard to how we pay for it. I think the cable analogy is a really good one, and that the thing we're actually going to see is we're going to see not a payment for particular services. I mean, you might buy a larger bundle of services or pay for different speed. But I think what we'll really start to see is we'll start to see the payment passed to the content providers. And so the real payment's going to be Netflix is going to pay a lot extra to put their signal out, mm-hmm. which means that a lot of the content services are going to cost more individually.
Mm-hmm. But excuse me. I mean, a natural question for me might be Netflix. We already pay them if we're subscribed to them. YouTube. If they wanted a subscription website, they would just do that, but they choose not to. So why doesn't that take care of it?
Well, it doesn't, because you have to think about what the nature of this of the current system is in terms of moving the internet out to people with broadband. When they decided to, or the cable companies decided to get into the business, they were using public rights of way. They were using existing technologies that were provided so that they could do broadcast, the broadcast of cable services. So they now are making the claim that their business is being hampered because they can't do what they would like to do. They had this possibility of restriction on their ability to charge for the things that they have to pay out for, the higher bandwidth kinds of things. And it's a really, to me, it's an extremely spurious argument, because the only reason that the cable company exists in a monopoly format is because they were given access to the public right of way across my land and your land. If they'd had to go out and negotiate all that kind of thing on their own, there wouldn't be any business there. So in exchange for that, that public access right, to go through through property, they have to be regulated like a utility. And they're an infrastructure, and infrastructure shouldn't be charging tolls, particularly in an unregulated fashion, on the folks that use the infrastructure. I mean, I don't think we would be too happy if every state that you went to had a different mechanism for charging how you drive on the public highway. I was talking about this with an associate on earlier this week. He said, well, they charge for trucks. They charge a relatively predictable rate for trucks, and they certainly don't discriminate from one trucking company to another based upon some other business relationship they've got. The state has a fee for tonnage. Mm-hmm. So this business about allowing somebody that benefits from public infrastructure to charge these differential fees is really, to me, really off-putting.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting here. I don't know who can answer this, but we have this FCC ruling, the vote coming up, Jeff and Tony, on something that could really have a dramatic effect on the future development of internet access in this country, what we pay for internet, what we have access to. So why isn't Congress in on this so that we as constituents have a say, or do we?
Well, you know, Congress might step in eventually, and I think that would probably be the best thing. I think we need some statutory clarity here about what the FCC's authority is in this area. We learned from the Comcast decision earlier this year that, you know, the FCC does not have the authority to apply Title I regulations on, or excuse me, Title II common carrier regulations on what they have classified under Title I of the Communications Act, which is broadband internet service. What the FCC really needs to do is to more appropriately classify broadband internet under Title II, and therefore they could apply common carrier regulations to broadband internet service providers. My understanding of the current proposal is that the FCC is going to try to claim that they have some justification to apply Title II regulations to what they've already classified under Title I, and that legally is a very spurious argument.
Mm-hmm. As we gather from this conversation, as I gather from this conversation, it's a very complicated system we're talking about, very confusing. And I can only guess the general public is we are all very ignorant of these changes, not aware of these ramifications. So what are you saying people can do to get informed and voice an opinion? Anything?
Well, there's certainly a lot of groups that have been active on this. Electronic Frontier Foundation, Free Press, just to name a couple. But really, to be aware and, you know, to let your representatives in Congress know that you are aware of what's going on and that it's important. I guarantee you that no matter what the FCC does on the 21st, it's going to result in a court challenge. And you know, without congressional action, I'm certain this is going to be resolved in the courts.
Tony Townsend, we're in the midst of the doldrums, have been for several years in our economy. What could the FCC ruling mean for job creation?
Well, I think what it's my concern about part of the ramification of this is that the content providers start to look like content providers that go to cable, which means a lot of consolidation of the content services into, you know, mega media companies as opposed to micro media companies. Mm-hmm. But what that means, though, is that you'll start to see like the rise of something like a Viacom, you know, for, you know, internet content. And that consolidation will have benefits if it's going to result in, you know, cheaper access to the web and stuff like that. It's not to say that some of these things don't exist already, but this is going to push them more that direction. And anytime you get extensive consolidation like that, you start to lose opportunities for entrepreneurial ventures, for new startups, new models, you know, of content generation. And so I'm concerned that by charging for the access, you know, in a deliberate fashion like that, you're going to stymie the development of an awful lot of potential, very beneficial kinds of growth. And both in terms of what's available for consumers as well as what's available to put jobs into the economy.
Jeff Blevins with us, associate professor at Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. Tony Townsend, you heard just there, associate professor of Management Information Systems at ISU's College of Business. Your questions about net neutrality, questions about how we get access to the Internet, perhaps that have bugged you, you wanted to know, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. So can you lay out in simple terms, as you see it, gentlemen, who will profit most if this change takes place? And who are the winners and who are the losers? I've got my right hand up, I've got my left hand up, and I'm going to keep a tally in each column.
Cable companies, you know, I mean,
they're the big winners. Okay,
broadband service providers. Yeah, well, DSL as well. You know.
Okay, so name some of the names that we were talking about.
Well, MediaCom, Comcast. I don't know who's.
I think those are the two biggies. But yeah, you know, it's, you know, the ISPs are going to be the big winners. They want a two-sided market. They want to be able to charge you, the user, for access to the network, and they also want to charge content providers to put content on the network. And they certainly want to favor content that they have either an ownership interest in or some type of strategic business relationship.
Mm-hmm. So, and the losers?
All the rest of us.
That's me and you, yeah.
So these large companies, Mediacom, Comcast, are they seeing problems in the future as far as their bottom line? Is that why they're doing this?
Yeah, well, from an operational standpoint, the continuing expansion of demand, the consumer demand for internet services, means that you've got to build out your network, this constantly expanding network, and paying for that is not cheap. But they're doing quite well, and they can charge more for the broad service if it becomes prohibitive for them to build out the various, gigabit wire services. No one's saying that they can't charge for the fiscal responsibility of providing internet access. It's just this, what I think Jeff very correctly described, is this double dipping on who they're charging and not having a direct relationship to the real cost of doing business.
Join our conversation as we close this hour, talking about network neutrality, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Rick in Cedar Rapids writes us an email asking, don't phone companies charge for infrastructure based on usage? As an internet user who doesn't need much bandwidth, won't my cost go down if cable companies are allowed to charge Facebook users more? Finally, why won't competition work? Asks Rick in Cedar Rapids.
Well, you got to wonder where the competition is. I mean, there's. It's like you've got two gas stations in your town. They're across the street from each other. Their prices tend to look pretty much the same. You've got DSL, you've got cable, and the only competition for that right now is a variety of wireless broadband services, which are, priced pretty high for the cellular services. And out here in Iowa, we've got, PrairieNet, mm-hmm. wireless broadband service and stuff like that. But these are really minor players. The real competition is between, two whales in the water, and they're setting what the prices are going to be. So in the absence of competition, I can't see that these things there's a lot of opportunity to have prices go down. The other thing that's taking place at the same time as all of this is a continuing conversation on the part of the service providers to charge these differential rates based upon how much you use. And they said, well, we'll give you 5 gigabits for your current, $40 a month or $35 a month. Mm. What is that, like one movie, that you get
right.
to watch your 5 gigabits?
And it was a few years ago that we were had some of this model there that you were charged depending on how much you downloaded a month, right? So we're going back to that possibly?
Yeah, I mean that's what they would like to do. I think the classic example of how messed up this industry is with this kind of stuff, the exploitation that you're seeing on the part of the providers, is the iPad takeoff services that were offered for cellular. If you bought your iPad with the 3G service, you paid $30 a month for unlimited service. Well, they changed that contract right in the middle of it, and now if you drop your service and come back in, you get 5 gigabytes a month or something like that, and it's not what they promised initially. And this continual cycle of looking for ways to nickel and dime the consumer to put more profit on the table is fine. I'm coming out of a college business, and I'm fairly conservative or libertarian, certainly my own politics. But if you're going to operate across the public system and you're going to operate in a monopoly fashion, you've got to be regulated. And in answer to an earlier question, you were talking about, why is the FCC sort of set this thing out? When cables came online heavily in the 1980s, they started before that, but they really expanded in the 80s. There was a belief that the local cable boards were going to regulate these entities. And so you had county commissions or city commissions that would put the cable, stuff under their jurisdiction. They authorized the build-out. They made the deals with the cable company. They set the service rates and everything else with them. I don't think the cable boards have been doing their job on this. So just sitting here thinking, if I had to do something, personally to try to get, some order into this thing, I think I'd be pushing the cable boards. I don't know who the cable board is anymore. Do we have one in Ames? I don't know, Jeff.
Okay. We can say the same thing about the FCC these days.
It's really
been slack.
Yeah.
Jeff and Tony, we have about a minute left. Give me your best guesses on how this will spin out for us in this vote and also for us, the consumers?
Well, I certainly think it's going to be a very close vote. If it passes, it'll pass by a 3-2 margin along party lines. But as I said earlier, I see this being resolved in the courts ultimately, because I think the FCC is really on shaky legal ground here. I think if they really want to move forward with network neutrality regulation, they need to classify broadband service under Title II and not trying to apply Title II regulation to something that they've already classified under Title I.
So this very much does break down along partisan lines.
Absolutely. The swing vote in this currently is Commissioner Copps, a Democrat, and there is some concern that he may not vote for it simply because he thinks it doesn't go far enough, that this would be a very weak form of net neutrality.
Very good. We'll have to leave it there. Jeff Blevins, Tony Townsend of Iowa State University, thank you very much for clearing up some of the confusion about this. We'll see how it affects us. Very complicated area. Thank you for enlightening us, both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, production assistants today from Dennis Reese as well. In Ames, we had help from Michael Yeager. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.